Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, Campus Radio FM audience. Tonight is the last night of the WIPS seminars, the last session of the WIPS seminars in this academic year 2011-2012. And I am also the giver of the paper, as well as the general honshu or chair. My name is Paul Clow. I teach anthropology at the University of Malta. And this work in tonight's paper draws on and continues work which began with a paper I published in 2007 in the journal Social Analysis called The Relevance of Kinship to Moral Reasoning in Culture and in the Philosophy of Ethics. And that was published in Social Analysis in 2007. My main empirical research interest at the moment is African immigration in Malta. But my main theoretical interest at the moment happens to be the moral dimension of culture, because I have thought for a long time that the moral or ethical dimension of culture has been rather under-theorized in both anthropology and sociology. So my 2007 paper was an attempt to address that. One of the readers of that paper, Terry Evans at the University of North Carolina, wrote to me that I should read Levinas. So that began my excursion into Levinas. And tonight I try to bring Levinas to bear on conflict resolution among African immigrants in the light of Emmanuel Levinas's moral philosophy. Hence the title of tonight's paper, and hence its heading, Ultimate Moral Experiences. However, it is based on and draws upon a paper that I read to this same WIPS seminar in 2009, which was entitled Conflict Resolution Among African Irregular Immigrants, The Micropolitics of Intercultural Respect. In my 2009 paper, I gave an ethnographic exploration of how the manager at the Marsa Open Center in the year 2006, Terry Gosden, handled a very, very particular conflict between two factions of Sudanese in the Marsa Open Center. Tonight's paper actually is an attempt to analyze that ethnographic material in terms of Emmanuel Levinas's notions of morality. But first, let me quote some extracts from the 2009 paper to put you all in the context. There are various official centers for the housing of immigrants released from detention in Malta. At the time of my research, Marsa Open Center was the largest and was constantly expanding. In December 2005, Marsa Open Center had 400 residents. By 2009, the number had grown to over 700. The government had delegated its running to a local NGO, at the time Surat El Benidim, who were provided with governmental and EU funds. From July 2004 until August 2008, the manager of Marsa Open Center was an officer of that NGO, Mr. Terry Gosden, an English social worker resident in Malta with dual nationality and a Maltese wife. During that time, he developed with great speed, under conditions of stress, a uniquely harmonious residence in which immigrant males from many different conflict zones in Africa were encouraged to live together peacefully, find employment in the Maltese labor market, pool their resources for the joint running of entertainment facilities and MOC, which could not be provided from limited state resources, individually invest as private entrepreneurs in the development of restaurants, shops, and internet outlets on the premises, develop mosques, prayer rooms, and religious schools which express the diverse religious needs of the immigrants. In March 2006, the Council of Europe underlined many shortcomings in the treatment of immigrants which needed to be addressed by the government of Malta. Nonetheless, it's ended by singling out the Marsa Open Center as a dynamic and successful site of migration management. My paper of 2009 explored a single case of conflict within MOC, as I will call it from now on, in order to probe the dynamics of conflict management. MOC is a large former school in the socially marginal dockland of Marsa at the end of Grand Harbor. The majority of residents were Somalis, among many African national and ethnic groups. But since the eruption of the genocide in Darfur, an increasing number were from Sudan. Terry Gosden, the manager, had responded to the pleas of various national groups by letting either individuals or national groups lease and manage what he called restaurants, large rooms where they had kitchens, tables, and benches, and cooked their local dishes. One of these was the Sudanese restaurant, under the overall control of a committee of Sudanese immigrants who lived at MOC. It had delegated the task to a middle-aged manager whom I will call Jibril. Like a number of Sudanese in MOC, he was not actually from Darfur. Jibril was an Arab born and raised in Sudan, which turned out to be, as Terry Gosden found out, to be one of the causes of conflict between him as manager of the restaurant and a faction of Sudanese at Mars Open Center. In August 2006, i.e. 2 years after many harmonious arrangements were up and running, Gosden was confronted by a strong demand from a group of angry Sudanese that he remove Jibril and hand over the management of the Sudanese restaurant to them. He refused. Only 2 days later, damage was done inside the restaurant. The police were called in, and the restaurant was closed. Gosden was faced with three realistic options. One, keep the restaurant closed. This would reaffirm his authority and that of the government's immigration services, but risk discontent among Sudanese residents and a deterioration in the intercultural harmony which he had established at the center. Two, hand the restaurant back to Jibril, thereby confirming his managerial control, but risking intra-group conflict among the Sudanese. Three, negotiate between Jibril and his opponents. This would risk his own authority as manager of MOC, but turn an escalating conflict into a more peaceful process. In fact, Gosden chose the third and final option. At the end of the case, after intense and delicate discussions, he managed to reopen the Sudanese restaurant with a new manager and his authority enhanced. My paper of 2009 analyzed how. One of the first innovations that Gosden had introduced was the appointment of an immigrant resident at the MOC as his deputy on the NGO payroll, Mr. Warsami Garari. Warsami had himself been in detention. Highly educated, quiet, and diplomatic, this sensitive man in his early 30s was fluent in Arabic, the lingua franca among Somalis and Sudanese, French, Italian, and English. He became Gosden's intermediary with many residents. So my case study of 2009 was really the story of their creative partnership. In my 2009 paper, in demonstrating ethnographically the political skills which the manager Terry Gosden and brought to bear, and the bargaining techniques which he brought to bear to resolve this conflict between the faction of what I call the wreckers, who did the damage to the restaurant, and the faction who clustered around the manager of the time, Jibril, I reached the following conclusion. Full explanation of this case study is impossible without considering the ethical motivation of the manager, Terry Gosden. I infer from the manager's biography, as from the pattern of his words and actions, a refusal to countenance suffering. As poor child, pushed around British naval seamen in the Royal Navy, residential social worker in London caring for violent youths with AIDS, and as a Maltese manager encountering Africans for the first time in his work experience, his imperative was to sympathize with those in pain. Thus, we should avoid an account of conflict resolution situated entirely within the discourse of rationality, including the calculations involved in political move and counter-move. Rather, we need to resort to a discourse of ethics in and for alterity, as when Immanuel Levinas writes of the face of the other. The face of the other is a key metaphor in Immanuel Levinas. Infinity presents itself as a face in the ethical resistance that paralyzes my powers, and from the depths of defenseless eyes rises firm and absolute in its nudity and destitution. The being that exposes itself imposes itself, but does so precisely by appealing to me with its destitution and nudity, its hunger, without my being able to be deaf to that appeal. The presentation of being in the face does not leave any logical place for its contradictory. Says Rabbi Yochanan, because Immanuel Levinas was also a Talmudic scholar, as well as being a French philosopher, says Rabbi Yohanan, to leave men without food is a fault that no circumstance attenuates. The distinction between the voluntary and the involuntary does not apply here. Before the hunger of men, irresponsibility is irrecusable. The face, therefore, opens the primordial discourse, whose first word is obligation. Well, in the 2009 paper, I ethnographically explored the threat which was delivered to Terry Gosden, the actual breaking up of the equipment in the Sudanese restaurant, the further threats which he was exposed to by the same group of men. I described the first meeting he convened with the various factions in order to try to get at the causes of the dispute and to see underneath a fairly fixed facade, to see whether there were in fact any reasons for grievance with Jibril, the then restaurant manager. And this involved a lot of discursive skill and a lot of theatrical play on his part, which I tried to record. In the second meeting, he found out that it was very, very difficult to get any of them to swear on the Quran as to how much damage had actually been done in the restaurant. And this led him to certain insights into African culture, which actually fascinated him. At the end of the meeting, Jibril, the restaurant manager, quietly claimed 500 lira was missing and 150 lira of food destroyed. Gosden quietly indicated to all, without directly dismissing Jibril, that the restaurant would remain closed indefinitely unless they worked out a mutual agreement by African culture. At that moment, he was at a loss, because he thought by getting them to swear on the Quran, he could culturally make them actually admit as to the precise damage, rather than make inflated claims one way or the other. Terry's comment on this episode was as follows. At the start of every meeting, I made sure I gave long salutations for family, friends, about the weather. At the end of every meeting, no matter how arduous, I made sure everybody shook hands and said thank you. I then go on to describe in the 2009 paper how he sent Warsami, his deputy, into action, and that it was Warsami who brokered a meeting between the various factions in private. And then finally, Warsami's meeting brought together the imam of the mosque at Marsa Open Center, an Eritrean, Jibril, the manager, and the old original Sudanese committee who had set up the restaurant in the first place. Interestingly, the meeting took place in the mosque, which Gosden had promoted and opened 2 years previously. Thus, Terry Gosden clothed a mundane agreement with the authority of the sacred. Then I go into an account in the 2009 paper of Warsami's whole interpretation of the dispute. And Warsami said, everything would be in the hands of the old committee. They would run the restaurant, but give the earnings to Jibril, who would have left the restaurant, until such time as he, Jibril, had recouped whatever damage had been done. Afterwards, a new committee would be elected by all of the Sudanese, and Gosden would appoint a new manager. I then go into other meetings, which Gosden called, but the important point is that Warsami did broker an agreement. At which it was agreed that in exchange for some compensation, Jibril would eventually stand down. At the end, I went into Gosden's assessment of the final agreement. Later that night at the pub, Gosden gave this assessment. It's clear the business of the meeting was to dispatch Jibril. These are Gosden's words. The Sheikh said that there would be a meeting next week of all Sudanese to discuss a new manager for me to choose. As for the envelope given to Jibril, there was only 250 lira in the envelope. The committee assessed the damage to Jibril's property and the money he had lost, and subtracted from this amount the money they had lost by not reopening the restaurant when they had wanted to do so. Then they came up with the amount. So you can see that Sudanese Africans have a fine understanding of opportunity cost. I had wanted Jibril to leave the meeting before the others so that I could discuss possible names for a new restaurant manager, but clearly the committee wanted to keep that decision for itself. I was slow in seeing this trend in their thinking. I'm exhausted. Tonight at the meeting, I was searching every face for clues, but all eyes were down. Looking back, at the end of the 2000 paper, I asked Gosden why he had pushed himself so much while he was manager at Marsa. Gosden's reply was this: I was firefighting all the time. On the way home from work, I used to pull into the lay-by at the golf course and sleep for an hour. I suppose there's a sense of injustice and the romantic notion of the English stereotype of being on the side of the underdog. I'm a self-proclaimed socialist. I come from the working class. At the same time, I'm a confusion. I'm middle class. I don't know myself. Well, in working out an analysis of the ethnography contained in the 2009 paper, I've considered primarily two issues: the conduct of power in micro-political situations and ethics as a motivating force in politics. Today, I will very briefly touch on the issue of power and then focus on ethics. In History of Sexuality, Foucault outlines an understanding of power keyed to micropolitics. Power comes from below in the sense that there is no all-encompassing opposition between rulers and ruled at the root of power relations and serving as a general matrix. Rather, power is that multiplicity of shifting force relations that have to be analyzed as immanent to the particular local spheres in which they operate, as a process of ceaseless interchange, and in terms of the strategies of the actors. And of course, in developing this analysis, I referred particularly to the various strategies of discourse that Foucault outlines, because for Foucault, the word really is made flesh. The word really is. Discursive strategies really are crucial in effecting actual force relations in micro-political situations. At a general level of analysis, Foucault advanced a rule for the probing of power, the rule of double conditioning. There is no discontinuity between micro and macro strategies for the organization of force relations, such that these are different realities. But at the same time, neither is there homogeneity such that one is the enlargement or the miniaturization of the other. In Malta, a macro discourse of tolerance and human rights, accepted by both the government and opposition parties, and officialized by the Ministry of Justice and Home Affairs, which was responsible for immigrants, enabled Gosden to push ahead with his micro discourse among immigrants of democracy. Conversely, his micro discourse of democracy among immigrants, and in this particular conflict I was describing to you, forestalled flashpoints of violence that might have weakened or eventually upset a macro discourse of human rights in a period of, in Malta, of racial and cultural tension. While Foucault had much to say on the ways in which competitive definitions of the truth inflect the final disposition of force relations in local conflicts, he had little or nothing to say on the ways that symbolism, the discourse of the gesture, notions of right and wrong, good and evil, the discourse of legitimacy, and performative utterance, the discursive build-up to the final act of agreement or dealing or resolution, enter political struggles. Anthropologists have written revealingly and often on symbolic action and performative utterance as crucial forms of communication. For but two classic examples, see Geertz on the semiotic nature of political action or on rituals of transition. What has been much less explored by anthropologists is the role of ethics as either implicit attitude or explicit belief in the gestation of political actions. Yet in his manner of conducting politics, Gosden was demonstrably driven by the general determination to resist the use of force, either by the wreckers or by outside forces such as the police, and even more widely by the desire to prove the possibility of harmonious living among African immigrants. These, I would argue, are ethical motivations. This brings me to the theoretical focus of today's paper, ethics. I see in this case study of empirical two points of empirical observation that require an analysis in terms of ethics. First, an intense striving on behalf of and towards the Africans on the part of the manager. And secondly, a profound bending towards each other of the rather violently contesting African groups. These reveal the humanity of both the manager and the Africans and cannot be fully explained by a social science of factionalism, which I could elaborate, or by a theory of political strategy based on calculations of net material advantage in a discursive game of power. However revealing those aspects of analysis might be, in order to highlight the ethical factor in the case study, I will outline those themes and only those themes in the ethical philosophy of Manuel Levinas that seem immediately relevant to an understanding of this particular case of micropolitics. I'll go on to explore their philosophical and anthropological implications thereafter. What makes Levinas's thought so interesting with regard to the two points of observation just outlined, this striving toward Africans by the manager and this bending toward each other, as I describe it, of different Africans involved in a conflict? Levinas's ethics starts with the idea of society and of the social, and indeed he pays tribute to the influence of Durkheim on his thought. The difference is that whereas Durkheim analyzes society as transpersonal, observable empirically in social facts, Levinas defines society as the interpersonal, realized in the inexhaustibility of the self's bondage to the neediness of the other. This bondage is recognized by the self as an unconditional call to give, in Levinas's language. If the image for Durkheim's society is the multiplicitous collectivity, the figure for Durkheim's society is the atomic bond between two persons. Levinas presents the shattering impact of the other person on the self as an experience that is ethical as opposed to sensory. But it is an experience no less existential than sense perception for being impossible to define in the language of sensory experience, or of the a priori presuppositions behind what is given in sense data. Whereas for Durkheim, the basic building block of human sociality is the social group in its organization and collective representations, for Levinas, it is the ethical challenge of the other person. This challenge has the intimate nature of an awareness of unlimited responsibility for the other person as encountered by the self in each of the situations of daily life. Ethics does not, in its primary meaning, consist of abstract principles or rules. These develop later in human time out of the experience of unlimited responsibility for the singular personal other. Rather, it consists of an elemental impact so prior to self-consciousness as to be the other's expression in silence, presentation of need, that calls forth from the self the giving of a gift before self-consciousness or calculation. For the Levinas, the need in the expression of the other person evokes a gift from the self in a unity of expression evoking gift that is, the, for Levinas, what he calls the aboriginal communication, constituent of human subjectivity. For that reason, it is the wordless beginning of all language. And thus, it is the wordless inauguration of all reasoning in the sense of framing propositions about observable reality. If, for Durkheim, sociality emanates from the human group and its symbols, for Levinas, it arises from a pre-conscious acknowledgement of responsibility to the other person that makes the ethical challenge and response the source of all communication or language. This acknowledgement is attended by a sense of the inexhaustibility, that's my word for Levinas's word, which is infinity, by a sense of the inexhaustibility of the self's responsibility for the other person. It follows in an entailment upon which Levinas himself does not ever dwell, that since the other as a self is experiencing an equally unlimited responsibility to the self as others, the tissue of human society is inconceivably dense. Some key ideas and terms in Levinas. Levinas's two major philosophical works were Totality and Infinity, 1961, and Otherwise Than Being, 1974. Tonight I'll also be drawing quite heavily on his little book, Conversations with Philip Nemo, Ethics and Infinity. For those of you who think this is a cop-out, all I can say is that when I first read the book, I did not understand a word. And it's only with struggling with passages from totality and infinity and otherwise in being that I found this, in fact, a revealing commentary by the philosopher himself on his own major work. So that's my justification for making use of ethics and infinity tonight. In Totality and Infinity, 1961, he develops the metaphor that inhabits his subsequent writing, the face of the personal other. It contains the dual idea of inviolability and vulnerability. The face is meaning, meaning all by itself. It is uncontainable. It leads you beyond. The relation to the face is straightaway ethical. It is that whose meaning consists in saying, "Thou shalt not kill." That's from Levinas' Ethics and Infinity. The face speaks. It is in speaking that it renders possible and begins all discourse. The authentic relation with the other is discourse and responds or responsibility. The mastery of the other over me and his poverty compared with me command my response. Again, Ethics and Infinity. Levinas also developed his idea of the saying, the natural response of the self to the inviolability and vulnerability of the other. Since Levinas cites the key texts in the Hebrew scriptures, we know that he had in mind hineni, here I am, in the sense that I am at your service, send me to meet your need. This is taken from Hilary Putman's interpretation in Cambridge Companion to Levinas. Hilary Putman characterizes the saying as any performative utterance that indicates the self's availability for the other. However, in a later work of God Who Comes to Mind, De Dieu qui vient à l'idée, 1982, Levinas shows that he also meant a wordless giving as acknowledgement of being bound to the need of the other, even before self-consciousness. This silent, non-self-conscious, pre-originary giving inaugurates all communication. Levinas in Of God Who Comes to Mind. If silence speaks, it is prior to the hyperbolic passivity of giving, which is prior to all willing and thematization. This saying is thus like silence. It is without words, but not with hands empty. In Otherwise Than Being, 1974, Levinas explores two key ideas of interest for my analysis. The first is responsibility. He uses it in a sense equivalent to obligation and often interchanges the two words. Yet this takes us no closer to real understanding. Indeed, we shall see that his responsibility escapes translation into another word. His usage is profoundly extroverted in a way that is oriented to the personal other rather than to an abstract checklist of duties. He takes it to a logical extreme that literally defines the substance of the human as an ethical involvement with a personal other that has no condition. Taken from Ethics and Infinity. I understand responsibility as responsibility for the other, for what is not my deed, or for what does not even matter to me. Since the other looks at me, I am responsible for him, without even having taken on responsibilities in regard. For the other, pour l'autre. I am responsible for his very responsibility. Levinas's idea is intrinsically linked with the second idea, human subjectivity. According to Levinas, again in Ethics and Infinity, responsibility is the essential, primary, and fundamental structure of subjectivity. I describe the subjectivity in ethical terms. The very node of the subjective is knotted in ethics, understood as responsibility. For Levinas, responsibility for the responsibility of the personal other is entailed in the very concept of the person conceived of as an individual, as a discrete person among persons. It is part of the existential base of the individual. It precedes intentionality. Responsibility for the other is so radically intrinsic to subjectivity that it exists whether accepted or refused, whether knowing or not knowing how to assume it, his emphasis. Thus, I understand Levinas to mean, subjectivity is my acknowledgement of responsibility for the personal other before I am aware of myself. A very difficult philosophical idea. if subjectivity originates in the self's responsibility for the personal other, it reaches its apotheosis in self-sacrifice. The fulfillment of self is the denial of self. Nevertheless, it would be mistaken to translate Levinas as intersubjectivity, which is how some people translate Levinas. For the uniqueness of each subjectivity is the individual's awareness of a crushing weight, the unbearable pressure, the untransferability, in his words, of the self's responsibility for the personal other. Intersubjectivity, therefore, would be a blurred construction of Levinas's thought. One of the paradoxes in Levinas's ethics is that each unique identity is only realized in an utter emptying of the self. Toward the end of Ethics and Infinity, he says, "My responsibility is untransferable. No one could replace me. It is a matter of saying the very identity of the human I. Responsibility is what is incumbent on me exclusively. I am I in the sole measure that I am responsible, a non-interchangeable I. I can substitute myself for everyone, but no one can substitute himself for me." It is in this precise sense that Dostoevsky said, "We are all responsible for all men before all, and I more than all the others." It is important to note that for Levinas, a moral principle of reciprocity is entirely secondary to the essential meaning of ethics, the self's unlimited responsibility for the personal other, if indeed reciprocity is even considered to be ethical by Levinas. Levinas's understanding of reciprocity is that it would place a condition on the unlimitedness of the self's responsibility, i.e., it would entail that the self's performance of unlimited responsibility depends upon reciprocation by the personal other. Levinas will not have this. He says, it is precisely insofar as the relationship between the other and me is not reciprocal that I am subjection to the other. Ethics and Infinity, page 101. Secondly, I come to the idea of infinity in Levinas. Levinas does not specify either limitless extent or endless duration. Rather, he refers to the unlimitedness of responsibility, duty without end. From this perspective, his infinity could be translated as inexhaustibility, the inexhaustible nature of duty to the other. However, on many occasions, he does use infinity in a manner that suggests a substantive. Nonetheless, Hilary Putman argues in Cambridge Companion to Levinas that these occasions do not report a kind of magnitude. Infinity does not report a kind of magnitude. But as with Descartes, the shattering experience of reality that breaks all of the self's categories. The experience of the other disrupts the self's understanding of reality. Understood thus, any tension in Levinas's approach to infinity is resolved. Yet Putman's resolution is arguably too easy. It glosses over the extraordinary paradoxicality of Levinas's writing about the imminent. It is as though humans, in acknowledging inexhaustible responsibility to the other, cannot help but conceive of God. And I quote from Levinas, who himself was quoting from Otherwise Than Being. "I am not afraid of the word God. To my mind, the infinite comes in the signifyingness of the face. The face signifies the infinite. It never appears as a theme, but in the fact that the more I am just, the more I am responsible. One is never quits with regard to the other. It is the exigency of holiness." And some of you will be familiar with his famous cafe conversation with his friend Derrida, in which he said to Derrida, "You know, people say that my work is about obligation. In fact, all I'm really interested in is holiness." The infinite commands, and in this sense it is interior. The glory which does not affect me as a representation or as an interlocutor, before which and before whom I put myself, glorifies itself in my saying. The commandment is stated through the mouth of him it commands. The infinitely exterior becomes an interior voice. against Hillary Putman, I interpret Levinas's writing as containing this idea, even though he himself never acknowledges it. In experiencing the implacable inexhaustibility of responsibility of the person, the self is so chastened as to receive the idea of the unlimitedness of otherness itself. Two ideas are thus indissoluble, and so are one experience. Nor is there in this idea of endless duration, nor is this an idea of endless duration as opposed to unlimited extent. Rather, it is the experience of the plenitude of the moment of responsibility. Consider the following passage from Of God Who Comes to Mind, 1982. Ethics is not a moment of being. It is otherwise and other than being, the very possibility of the beyond. In this ethical reversal that orders the approach to the other, God is drawn out of presence and being. He is neither an object nor an interlocutor. His absolute remoteness, transcendence, turns into my responsibility. This analysis implies that God is other than the other, autre qu'autrui, other with an alterity prior to the alterity of the other, prior to the ethical bond with another, and different from every neighbor, transcendent to the point of absence. In this confusion, the substitution for the neighbor, the sacrifice for the neighbor, gains in disinterestedness, and the transcendent of the infinite shines in glory. The divine comedy is enacted equivocally between temple and theater, but in it the laughter sticks to one's throat when the neighbor approaches, that is, when his face or his forsakenness draws near. Levinas, Of God Who Comes to Mind, 1982. In the ecstatic utterance of Levinas, this calvary between temple and theater, this acceptance of the absolute otherness of the other person, contains an idea of the wholly other that is beyond the personal other. This idea is not experienced as a sense datum, but is entailed by the experience of the inexhaustibility of responsibility. I would argue that this idea is so close to experience that the difference between idea and experience is imperceptible. Admittedly, my own interpretation is in tension with many of Levinas's own statements. For example, ethics and infinity. The manifestation of the infinite is not disclosure. The characteristic of the relation to the infinite is that it is not disclosure. How then does it take on meaning? I will say that the subject who says, Hineni, here I am, testifies to the infinite. It is through this testimony and the revelation of the infinite occurs. So here we have an emphasis upon God not being known, but being testified to through the experience of responsibility. But I see that as being superseded or transcended in a way in some of his other work, where he seems to be conveying this idea of the absolute otherness itself, beyond the otherness of the other person, a playing on a dwelling or reflection on otherness itself. In this passage from Levinas, that I've just quoted from Ethics and Infinity, the infinite slips merely into language. Nevertheless, there is in the totality of Levinas's linguistic testimony to the infinite what I will call a logical mysticism. On a spectrum of discourse, beyond propositions about sense data, and further, beyond statements about the quality of personal responsibility, there hovers an entailment of the wholly other, who is other than the personal other, autrui qu'autrui. Its command is personal, and in that one respect, person-like. At bottom, my argument is that we cannot separate the content of Levinas's thought from its mode of expression. That mode is clearly a linguistic extremism. In Totality and Infinity, his first major work, following Merleau-Ponty, he writes that it is impossible to separate a thought from the language in which thought is expressed. Levinas. Disincarnate thought, thinking speech before speaking it, thought constituting the world of speech, adding a world of speech to the world antecedently constituted out of meanings, this is a myth. Already thought consists in foraging in the system of signs, in the particular tongue of a people or civilization, and receiving meaning from this very operation. This lovely expression of Levinas, thought is foraging in the system of signs. And yet, surely, in considering thought in language, we need to pay as much attention to its connotation, its loose meanings, even its emotional aura, as to its denotation, the meaning or meanings closely associated with its wording as these have accreted over time in a particular linguistic community. To read Levinas is to encounter, over and over again, a tone of voice which transfers the numinosity and awe of Durkheim's collective symbols to the face and to the other in the face, in an effort to apprehend jointly the sheer physicality of the expression of the other person and the otherness of the holy other. His ecstatic and intrinsically contradictory mode of expression is, for me, as much a datum of his thought as are the strict meanings normally associated with his words. Following thus his thought, I would argue that a strange possibility opens up. That is not a deepening of Durkheim, but rather Durkheim's radical reversal. Not that society founds God, but that the infinite who commands me is the origin of society, or at least of social interaction. That ends my attempted explication of some Levinasian ideas. Now I want to turn to its philosophical implications, and I will end with its anthropological implications. We are entitled to ask of Levinas that question so often asked in the Anglo-Scots philosophical tradition, a question in the common tongue asked testily. What do you mean by these claims? In other words, what is the basis of your claim concerning the unlimited, infinite nature of responsibility or its salience to subjectivity? What is their logical status? What is the nature of these formulas vis-a-vis propositions of empirical fact or the propositions of logic? Not least, on what kinds of evidence are you drawing when you frame these claims? I'm not saying that some of you would necessarily ask these questions of Levinas, only that, given my own philosophical tradition, the Anglo-Scots philosophical tradition, I cannot but think with these questions. I would answer for Levinas in the following manner. His writing makes no attempt to set forth propositions. As he continually states in Totality and Infinity, it is not a knowledge, his term. Yet neither is it a nonsense, however serious, in Simon Critchley's interesting comment on what Wittgenstein thought that Heidegger thought. In simple language, it is a reflection on human concern for the other person. Levinas examines the nature of concern itself from as many different viewpoints as he can muster. He is urging us to be aware of our awareness of a responsibility without limit for the personal other. This awareness comes from outside the self, from the other, and it is different from, but as indubitable as, our awareness of one, sense perceptions. Two, presuppositions behind sense perception, in other words, a priori concepts, such as time, space, number, causality, three-dimensionality. And three, the internal consistency of analytical tautologous propositions. Speaking as much of his mode of expression as of its content, of its connotations as much of its denotations, his writing is an invitation, it seems to me, to at least inspect our consciousness to see if it contains the same kind of awareness of the other person as does his. Solipsism, the philosophical denial of the reality of other persons and of the veracity of anything external to the self's consciousness, is not just dismissed tout court by Levinas as an authentic possibility, it is more deeply characterized by Levinas as utterly wrong. Nothing could be more wrong than to doubt the existence of other persons. The indubitability of the existence of other human beings cannot derive from a careful comparison of the sense data associated to them with the data associated to the self. I refer here to an article by Alfred Ayer attempting that very comparison, one of the first pieces of philosophical writing I ever read as an undergraduate. It derives rather from the moral certainty of their existence, because otherwise the ethical certainty of the self's responsibility to the other would be utterly undermined. If we follow Levinas, an insight thus opens up. Truth, in the strict sense of the security of propositions about sense perception, is founded on ethics, our ethical certainty of the existence of the personal other. Hence, Levinas's repeated insistence that ethics is first philosophy. I cannot ethically kill the other person, and therefore other persons, and therefore other persons exist. Levinas is arguing for a subtle but incontrovertible connection between the nature of certainty about other persons and about other things. Our knowledge of the truth of the external world is based upon a certainty, the certainty of which has nothing to do with sense data. It rather has to do with moral worry. Levinas radically wrests epistemology from its roots in a principle of verification and hurls it onto the undeniable nature of our worry for the other human. If epistemology is thus grounded in an ethic of responsibility, then a distinction of logic is entailed between sense perceptions, a priori concepts, consistent propositional chains in maths and logic, and certain states of moral awareness. Each of these different kinds of human experience is indubitable, but in different kinds of ways. The extravagance, the obvious extravagance of Levinas's prose is thereby linked to the plain but subtle statements in one school of Anglo-Scots philosophy, that of G.E. Moore. Moral qualifiers in language, words like right, wrong, good, responsible, are ultimately untranslatable into sense perceptions, or into a priori concepts derived from or intrinsic to sense perception, the categories of time, space, number, causality, and three-dimensionality. This line of thought extends at least from Hume through Sedgwick to Moore and Pryor. Asked whether the axiom of utilitarian theory was not self-evident, that the greatest net surplus of pleasure over pain of the greatest number of people is the very definition of good or right, Pryor replied that this would always and still be a significant statement to make, rather than a tautology. Moral statements, in other words, are of a different order of significance from propositions based in sense perception, but that does not reduce their basis in human experience. I end by considering my anthropological reservations about Levinas's thought and the consequences of Levinas's thought for the analysis of the case study of migration conflict in Marsan Open Center. This explication of Levinas does not remove my two reservations about his thought. They involve my understanding of reciprocity. First, I can only see a difference between Levinas's insistence on unlimited love for the other and the more balanced ethics of an Aristotle or a Jesus. In the words of Hilary Putman, Aristotle taught that to love others, one must be able to love oneself. In the words of Matthew or Mark, you must love your neighbor as you love yourself. In place of Levinas's single obligation, I would argue that people usually experience a more balanced sense of obligation between the self and the other, a kind of reciprocity of the self with the self, as well as with the other. Nevertheless, in some situations, this love, balanced between self and other, could imply altruism or open-ended generosity. In others, it could imply self-sacrifice. Secondly, my understanding of human experience is that people distinguish between what Meyer Fortes called, in his analysis of kinship, the obligation of amity or altruism, and a quite separate obligation to reciprocate. Indeed, I have argued elsewhere in my 2007 article that there are two contrasting rules in any population, one that orders generosity and one that prescribes equivalent return. Across diverse societies, people draw very different boundaries around the groups to which each rule applies. Their differentiation hinges on very different collective notions of self and other developed through time. Nevertheless, human moral distinctions involve sorting out other people into two categories, not one. Those to whom we act altruistically, and those to whom we act so as to achieve, through exchange, the mutual enhancement of satisfaction. A notion of mutuality, which Malinowski also talks about in Crime and Custom in Savage Society. Mutual enhancement through exchange can actually take the different forms of sharing and of equivalent return. But neither sharing nor equivalent return is reducible to altruism. Even less is it reducible to self-sacrifice. Reciprocity so conceived or enacted cannot be reduced to altruism. I argue, that is, for a binary account of moral language across human societies rather than, as with Levinas, a unitary account of moral language. Even so, Levinas's ethic does alert us to the fact that sometimes altruism informs reciprocal behavior in key ways. Closer inspection shows that behind the practices of reciprocity, there sometimes lurks something, lurks a more subtle ethic. To treasure and strive for collective situations of peaceful, harmonious exchange. Levinas would take this further. The ethical situation of demand and response involves a wordless, pre-conscious gift of the self to the other. Quote unquote, the hyperbolic passivity of giving, which is prior to all willing, without words, but not with hands empty. Levinas implies that beneath the reciprocity of gift exchange, there is an altruistic orientation to the other, from otherwise than being. There is an ambiguity of the order that orders me to the neighbor who obsesses me, for whom and before whom I answer by my ego, and in which my being is inverted into the very possibility of gift. In the evaluative hierarchy of at least some societies, for example, the Hausa of northern Nigeria, where I did my original fieldwork, the ethic of reciprocation of commercial loans as well as of gifts is informed and contained by a more general orientation toward interhuman respect, even, I would argue, kindness. Even given my criticisms of Levinasian ethics, I would argue that they enrich our understanding of the ethical factor in social action. First, the implacability of the ethical experience gives energy to human social action. It has to be said that social analysis is thus opened up to categorical imperatives that might be very different from, even abhorrent to, the categorical imperatives of Levinas. A crusade for fascism, for example, a self-righteous enforcement of one set of religious beliefs at the expense of others. In my case study, the pursuit of an understandable ethnic grievance to the point of excluding someone of a different ethnicity. However, note also in my case study, Terry Gosden's immediate reply to my question about his deputy Warsami's reasons for self-giving. I had asked Terry Gosden why Warsami, in all of these various negotiations and brokerages, was giving so much. And his answer was, Warsami's bound by the same code I am, but we don't need to talk about it. We can't walk away. Ethics thus have an existential dimension. To that extent, ethics involve less the application of abstract rules than a response to the personal other. This involves an optics. It invokes, moreover, the memory of past optics from which ethical lessons are drawn, as in the following comment by Terry Gosden. Warsami and I have seen too much damage in our lives. There's a quote, for evil to succeed, it only takes good men to walk away. Secondly, the tissue of social interaction is inconceivably dense in Levinas. For individuals are not so much forced toward each other against their individual wills as impelled towards each other by an ethical extroversion that in many cases endows the giving of self with a naturalness that defies rational calculations of individual cost and benefit. for all of Gosden's finesse in human calculation, for all of his love of the game, he was driven to play the game out of concern for the peace and harmony of his open center. In Gosden's reciprocal exchanges of language, gesture, and political or financial offer and counteroffer, I sense that he was locked into exchange with the African other out of a fascination with the face of that other, which was at the same time a commitment, in Levinas's words, a pre-originary anarchic. In consequence, rational choice theory is woefully incomplete as an account of human behavior in social groups. It is, moreover, superficial. I have argued elsewhere that a theory of maximization, according to which individuals take decisions either by maximizing their perception of net satisfaction after deducting costs, or by minimizing costs at a given level of satisfaction, is inherently vague. Now I would refine that argument further. Even in such situations where the benefit and costs are there for all to see, reciprocal maneuvering between parties to at least enhance individual net satisfaction can be informed by a deeper altruism that locks the competing parties into negotiation and thereafter skews the final outcome of their competition. In my case study, once Warsami and the Imam had engaged the faction of the wreckers and the old committee in negotiation, both sides gave way to compromise. The final meeting presided over by the manager, Terry Gosden, was more than just a rhetoric which sealed the agreed exchange of benefits and costs. It was also a response to the call for peace. It is easy enough for Foucault to urge a micropolitics of struggle and resistance, through which, and only because of which, power acquires a certain definition, and individuals or small groups attain the temporary liberation of an achieved identity before they resume their struggles anew. But it is far more difficult for this to happen in a multicultural milieu, where contesting groups do not share axioms concerning what is politically legitimate. In such situations, the possibility of an exchange of meanings, of a growing but genuine communication, deteriorates. All the more necessary, then, that there be in such crises contenders who proceed from a categorical sympathy for the pain of their opponents. Such persons are willing to suspend their judgments of the other in order to engage in the serious game of power. From contemplating the dilemma faced by Terry Gosden, and combining this with my consideration of Levinas's ethics, I am drawn to a final conclusion. An ethics for the other must also be a politics. Gosden's own comment on this last previous sentence, when I read it to him, was this: Africans seem very dignified, but you can see the pain. It is in their body language, their tonality. You can see it in its entirety. Yet, I would add, Gosden's kind of seeing is not necessarily visual, it is ethical. Anthropologists need to explore the extent to which reciprocal exchanges of discourse or of feeling or of things are often shot through with a reality deeper than the rationally calculated quest for at least an equivalent return. They are animated by altruism as an underlying, sometimes semi-conscious concern that reveals a deep as life orientation toward the personal other.
Thank you, Paul, for giving us such an in-depth presentation of the ethics of Levinas. I'm sure you are now going to be faced yourself with a number of questions. I had, if I could get the ball rolling, a small empirical question. You speak of the conflict in the open center as one involving factions. Yet, from what I can understand, there was the manager, the previous manager, the of Arab descent, and the committee who wanted to retake control of the restaurant that they gave him. So behind the individual, was there another group supporting the claims of the previous manager of the restaurant.
I didn't have time to go into the ethnography, but what I presented in my 2009 paper, which some of you have heard, is that in the course of the behind-the-scenes negotiation, Terry Gosdens and also Warsami found out that there were ethnic conflicts among the Sudanese, given that it's such a large country, and that basically the group who wanted to take over the restaurant from Jibril were in fact indigenes of Darfur who had, as it, they were a very, very well-known tribe, whose name immediately escaped me, it'll come to you in a second, who had suffered most from government forces and from the paramilitaries. And they therefore saw, they categorized Jibril as an enemy. Whereas the members of the old committee, who were quite happy to allow Jibril to remain, they tended to come from other ethnic groups in Darfur who had not been so badly hit by the genocide.
The other question I had regards the ethics of Levinas. To what extent do you think that the picture of ethics that Levinas presents is one that is more characteristic of what the oath rather than the is?
Well, you know, this is obviously one of the big questions in Levinasian studies. And my understanding of it is that, here I'll just take a stand, and I would say that I see Levinas as existentialist, and that he would therefore see any ought statement as following from is situation. In other words, oughts are reducible to is. But what he's really saying, and it's Simon Critchley who explains this, I think most well, and he explains it not only in the Cambridge Companion to Levinas, but also in that lovely little book, which you can get at Agenda, Very Short Introduction to Continental Philosophy by Simon Critchley, a book which is not just an introduction, it contains an argument of its own. And there he really seems to be making clear that what Levinas is doing, and I was rather gratified to read this because it supported my own interpretation, what I think Simon Critchley is arguing is that he changed from Totality Infinity, his 1961 book, to Otherwise Than Being, his 1974 book. In the latter book, he was really engaging in what simply, he was enacting what Simon Critchley calls a performative utterance. He was trying to literally test the limits of language in order to reveal the extent to which ethics, it is a situation. It's not a proposition that can be stated in the form which has a truth value. Thus, it is not part of ontology. It is, in other words, it is and is a deeply is situation, and one which is ultimately, ethics is not ultimately describable with propositions in language which can be verified as true or false. It is beyond language. I don't know, Clive Zamit, who has been supervised by Simon Critchley, I don't know if I'm conveying Simon Critchley's idea very, very well, I mean, correctly.
At the basis of this is Levinas's desire or motivation to move away from Heidegger, whose prime motivation was to make ontology fundamental, right? So we have the distinction between ontology and ethics in Levinas. So as the previous speaker said, obviously ontology would be the realm of the is, and Levinas wants to take ethics away from that, to distance it from Heidegger. So yes, he wants to take it to the realm of infinity, away from ontology, but to a realm which he states explicitly is an impossible realm. For Levinas, ethics, or his ethics, as infinity, is impossible. So it's beyond being, beyond the is, beyond ontology, but in a realm that would, in its infinity, is impossible. And that's why your last claim that any ethics of this sort has also to be a politics, if I understood you correctly, is very interesting, and I think raises a lot of problems, because for Levinas, politics is the end of ethics, in a way. It destroys ethics, because what he wants to get beyond is the collections, totalizing, the groupings which are implied in politics. So to say that his ethics also requires a politics is, you know, raises a huge tension there. So I have a lot of, I find that extremely interesting, but I also have a lot of problems with that. So that, I think, needs to be discussed further. It's very exciting.
Yes, well, I mean, I take your point. I think one is trying to do more than just use Levinas as a metaphor for the orientation of one toward the other. One is, I am prepared to, as it were, walk with him and see quite far with him, or speak as he does to quite a very, very large extent, having done that in order to talk about an inexhaustible responsibility, which is my translation of his word infinity, which he uses, still leaves us with the needs of ordinary life. And all I can say is, I think he was alive to those needs, at least in his early work, if not so much in his later work. So rather than just being in his later work a kind of experiment with words, and Critchley argues that otherwise than being is an experiment with words, a kind of explosion of language, trying to indicate that this burning sense of the other goes beyond delimitation in propositional form. To use this in context where there are human beings in transacting needs might involve the following resolution. We take from Levinas the idea of unlimited responsibility, but we then see that it is played out in very particular ways in individual situations. So that, so often in political disputes, the appropriate response is not simply to give way to the requests of others, but rather to negotiate them with as shrewdly as possible. So that's the way in which I want to indicate a possible resolution of the tension.
I'll just add a comment, but the manager of the Open Center told you, I don't know myself. And I really find that a kind of Levinasian kind of idea. I mean, I don't know myself. I think it's breaking the identity completely because of the encounter of the other. But I just wanted to ask you a question. The ultimate moral experience, would you say that it's an experience of violence then?
Which experience?
Your title is Ultimate Moral Experience.
Yes, yes.
So I'm just saying, is this an experience of violence?
I suspect you're asking me a question which would be taking me into philosophical territory with which I'm personally not familiar. For example, Derrida's response to Levinas was his first great article, Violence and Metaphysics, and I didn't understand that article. I read it and found it in quite uncooperative. So I'm aware that you might want to use the language of violence, and there's a violent turn to Levinas's language, that much I would say. So do ultimate moral experiences involve a level of violence? I think we would have to say yes if we were to draw on personal experience. The man who is implacable in his sacrificing for others is always saying, as Jesus said, I have no brothers or sisters or kin, which of course is a fairly violent act to do. So very often self-sacrifice and an ultimate moral acts do have. I think Levinas's ethics is compatible with what is, yes, with violence. Yes, Natalie.
You mentioned that Terry and the other guy felt caught up in this situation of sort of that they couldn't leave.
The other guy, which one?
Warsami? Yes, yes.
Yeah, the deputy, yeah?
The deputy, yes.
Yeah.
And this is in line with what you're trying to say from Levinas, the sense of responsibility, that they can't be replaced, etc. It would be interesting to know. I don't know if your ethnography extended to the time when Terry decided to leave.
Yeah.
What happened there? That's my question. What happened with that sense
you mean
of responsibility?
Yes. His relationship to Marsa Open Center and to the NGO. Mm-hmm. He resigned from the NGO in a series of fairly tortured conflicts over policy. at the place. He also resigned with them very specifically over an issue of how lenient to be with the immigrants there, who, as he explained it to me, were often double using beds, you see. And he was prepared to treat this practice leniently, but the NGO wanted to extricate a lot of people from the open center so that there would be one person per bed. In other words, they were thinking fairly bureaucratically, but he was prepared to think anti-bureaucratically. That comes out in the full ethnography of my first 2009 article. That's all I can tell you about the reasons why he resigned. But it was, there were growing disagreements of attitude towards migration management between him and the NGO who employed him. I think that's the best thing to say.
Paul, I found it very interesting that you sort of question anthropology and social sciences theories like rational choice theory and say that we could benefit from a more philosophical approach and looking, taking an ethical reading into behavior. And I would agree that we really need to do this in our sciences, so to speak. But your use of Levinas, you call him an existentialist. Now, I'm not a philosopher, so they can correct me. I actually read him as anti-Sartre, very much.
And what?
Anti-existentialist.
Yes.
And anti-Sartre, especially, because and perhaps this is the difference between someone who's sort of from a Christian background, so to speak, Sartre, who's talking a lot about conscience and choice and free will, in choosing between having good faith and bad faith, and another theory, which is saying there's only one way of being, and it's in our subjectivity to have our subjectivity. This, we have to have this ethical orientation to the other, and in this sense, if this is what Levinas is saying, and it's a sort of a universal theory and a unitary account of, then I don't know how you are saying you think it should be more binary, because actually what it's saying is to be human is to have this orientation to the face of the other.
Well, I think I need
and
to,
so
I,
he doesn't even consider that there would be in humanity that you wouldn't have it. And probably, as I see it, it's because of his experience as a Jew under Nazism. He was in detention, and he was in a camp in Germany, and he would have known other stories. And again, that for me would explain why he doesn't want to think in terms of groups. Also, he wants to think face to face with one other person. What do you do? And what is the one way that makes us human, that would count for every single human being? And in that sense, I don't think he's an existentialist.
You don't
actually
see any tension in him between...
No, I don't see him as an existentialist.
Oh, I see.
You know,
I
really.
I see.
Of course, I need to read more. And I do think, though, that you could use his philosophy to explain certain orientations, like Terry Gosden's was, and of others, beyond or sort of expanding social theories which are relate too limited, like rational choice theory. I would continue to do so.
Well, biographically, it's very, very clear that a man who lost his entire family, that is to say, his father, his mother, his brother, all in Lithuania, were destroyed by the Nazis, and who thankfully did not lose his wife, who was hidden by French friends. It was a transformative experience, and he never went to Germany again, despite his deep respect for Heidegger, and
he never forgave him
in Ethics and Infinity, in his conversations, he remained oriented towards Heidegger's whole mental template until the day he died. He admits that. He would never go to Germany after the war. So I think biographically that does explain the transformation that occurs. What I'm trying to do is to survey his work, to come up with some sort of adequate account of his work, and then secondly, to relate that to an adequate account of moral language is actually used by human populations. Because in a long-term attempt to see if Levinas' theory is usable in understanding the moral dimension of culture, this is where I'm trying to head to. Now, as far as his own internal consistency is concerned, don't forget all those passages where he talks about justice, and which he says that there is a condition which can be placed upon the my unlimited responsibility to the face of the other, namely that there are other others, and I must consider issues of equity as to how I should distribute my goods, my energies, whatever it is you want to consider. So he did talk a lot about justice. I've only begun to really read his stuff on justice. But he also made it clear that there was, I think, the tension that Clive Zamit is referring to. There's a tension in Levinas, which he admits, that on the one hand, it makes sense to say ethically I must practice equity in my relations with all other human beings, and yet that is necessarily in tension with the statement that I must give all to the need of the person in front of me. There's a tension there which cannot be resolved in logical terms or in terms of a language of propositions. And I can only use this, Mary, to suggest that au fond, at bottom, what he is doing in his later work is enacting this linguistic performance of the demand of the other upon me. That's, and he is getting back to JP's question. That's why I would have to say, that's why I use the word existential. That's why my answer to JP was yes, it's more about is than it is about ought. But in that very, very, very particular sense.
Perhaps it might be, I don't know if you've read Appiah's work, Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers. Because I think it would be, we would be also very Kwame Appiah, Appiah.
I've heard the name, yes, but I haven't.
Ethics in a World of Strangers.
Thank you.
Cosmopolitanism
is the heading.
Yes, okay. Cosmopolitanism, Ethics in a World of Strangers.
Paul, I had a question. To what extent do you think that Levinas doesn't really put forward a system of ethics or so much as a system of morality that's fundamentally grounded on a moral sentiment? It seems to me, rather than, as you're saying, it is not based upon propositions, but upon fundamentally a feeling, which leads to my second question from an ethnographic perspective. Does that ring true? I mean, in an age in which globalization has spread in new forms through mass media and whatnot, don't you see around you a degree of compassion fatigue, for want of
daughter fatigue. Compassion fatigue. Well, of course, Levinas had to deal with this rejoinder all the time in all his work, that the world does not work like that, that the sentiment to which referred simply is not evinced by human beings in many situations. Hilary Putman is quite famous for his distinctions between ethical philosophers who make grand narratives and large statements, and those who make very particular systems. And Hilary Putman says Levinas falls in the first category. He's a maker of large drawings, paintings, not a maker of specific ethical systems. But your other question about sentiment was very interesting. You see, I feel the need to continuously translate Levinas's very particular form of French philosophizing. I mean, his form of French philosophizing is far more lush, in Simon Christie's word, far more baroque than that of somebody like Foucault, who I find crystal clear. I mean, he may be a challenging thinker, Foucault, but it's all written in superbly clear prose, down to the comma, and down to the subphrase, whereas Levinas writes more like Derrida in these word pictures. He writes... His language is pictorial. It's a very, very pictorial approach. So he's painting, and he would accept so many of these tensions. He would accept. So I think he's talking, yes. I would want to translate this language into something more, as I said earlier, Anglo-Saxon. And I think, yes, it is rooted in sentiment.
You've said it in your paper. It's philosophy is style. Style is philosophy. So why would you want to look, you know, close Derrida or Levinas or, you know, into workable things, but I just want to put a different way of how to look at things. I think when I read at least Levinas, there's a desire for this other. And I think when you want to close down into a desire for this other, in the sense that this the presence, the face of the other, violates my identity, gives me who I am, makes me who I am. At least that's maybe a romantic reading of Levinas. But, you know, there's this constantly want to, for the other, and keeping the other as the other, but not, you know, to swallow the other into me. So there's a need for the other constantly to be present to in order to, I don't know, but...
Yes, well, I like your term. I like your term, desire. Yes, there is a lot of writing in Levinas. There's a lot of phenomenological writing in Levinas about desire. And my expression, which I think is terribly important, is that inconceivably dense tissue of society, which is a logical implication of his idea. That leaves open whether his idea would be regarded by you as true or false, or acceptable or unacceptable. But if my obligation to the other is infinite, he is experiencing the same, or she is experiencing the same toward me, hence an infinitely dense tissue of society. I like that as a metaphor. I like that very, very much as a metaphor. Desire, violence, you're indicating all of these as ways of also looking at his language. May I ask one question now? Getting back to you, Clyde, you made this interesting statement that Levinas wants to take ethics to a realm of infinity, where indeed ethics is impossible. Could you give me a bit more? Because I mean, I know you've read a lot of Heidegger and you've read a lot of Levinas and you've talked about it a lot. So what do you mean?
Let's start with the distinction between need and desire.
Okay.
Right. So needs are what is possible for me to satisfy, because
it's
needs,
possible to be satisfied.
Needs are, I can satisfy my needs, because needs are within the realm of ontology, of being. So I need a chair, I can find it and sit down. Or I'm hungry, I need food.
Yes.
Right? Now, now, within the realm of ontology, right, I'm terrorized by being. Levinas,
terrorized by need.
Terrorized by being.
Being.
By being itself.
Okay.
The Iliad, right? Remember, Levinas is obviously traumatized.
Yes.
And he wants to escape being. And on escape, for example, he talks about experiences of insomnia or hard labor, for example.
Yes, there's an incredible passage about insomnia in Otherwise Than Being, which I found very difficult to follow. Yeah.
Yes. Now, the example in insomnia is that in insomnia, you want to sleep, you want to get away from yourself. And it's not, you can't sleep, not because something is worrying you, but just because you can't get away from being. So there's nothing holding you there. It's the bare fact of being. So what the ego wants, what the subject wants, is to escape being. And you cannot escape being by drawing in other beings. So my need for other beings doesn't offer an escape for being, from being. What I need to get away from is the whole realm of ontology. Now, so what I'm after is not another need, not to satisfy another need, because satisfying another need implies other beings, so it increases my tie to being, right? So it increases my trauma, my terror. So here's where desire comes in. I desire something which is other than being. I desire alterity. And what I find in the face of the other is a trace of alterity, an open space.
A
trace. Something which I cannot comprehend totally, something which I cannot totalize, as the same way as I can do with a chair or with any other being. Right? So the face of the other opens a door or gives me a hope of this escape beyond being.
That's very interesting. It gives greater depth to his emphasis on the face.
Yes,
and the impact of the face and the obligation to this face.
Yes. So when you talk about the dense tissue, social tissue, I think that's extremely important, because if we were to read his infinite responsibility in normal terms, in normal language, then yes, this infinite responsibility would crush me. I would be unable to operate in society, right? I can't do anything. So I need an escape from this tissue. And the escape is in this trace, which I find in the face of the other. And I think infinity is a better term than inexhaustibility, because this escape can only come through time. And what I find missing in your paper is the relation to time, which I think is essential, because it is only through the opening of time, through infinity, that I can escape this this dense tissue of social responsibility. Because time, once I open up to the face of the other, what that gives me is time. And time in the sense that I can escape my past. I can escape that past, that being, that ego, which terrorizes me. And time, he says, therefore, slays the terror. It's something that redeems me. It redeems me from the terror of being.
Where does he say time slays the terror?
That's in totality and infinity.
Oh, really?
So, yes. So it's only through time that I can escape this dense social tissue, and then I can act again, because time wipes away all these ties. So I think infinity is a better term, because it holds on this relation to temporality.
Because I was trying to get away from ordinary definitions of infinity, and I could see that he was not about endless extent. And I used to think obligation without end was about endless duration. But then I began to think it's not about that. In other words, it's not spatio-temporal at all.
But then once you wipe away time, you can start reading responsibility in the sense that Derrida maybe later gives it more than Levinas himself, as responsibility, in which then forget about time, forget about the past, forget about, you know, what brought us to this situation. What we need to see now is how we can respond to the situation that we're in. And so by untying or cutting up those ties from the past, we can act again, because then our action is just a response to the situation we're facing now. So my responsibility would mean, am I able to respond to the situation I'm faced with? And this is what then responsibility would be. But if I, you know, pull everything along with me, if I drag along, you know, the chains of being, all my past, then I cannot act. You know, that drags me down.
That's very interesting. So it seems to me that I need to to go into parts of totality and infinity. You know, that's very, very essential. So you bring in the whole idea here of to depart from your past, to break your tie with your past,
yes,
as well as to break your tie with your needs. All of this implies sequence and implies the idea
and
of
obviously
moving into a new zone, and therefore
and only the face of the other can give you that. Because in the face of the other, what is implied is obviously forgiveness. So it's only the other that can forgive you your past, even if you're not guilty of anything. But
that's
you're still
very interesting to raise the issue of forgiveness, because I don't see forgiveness in his work at all. What I find very solipsistic about his work, if I must say so, is he's always concentrating on my obligation to the other and the beckoning of the face of the other. There isn't much talk about the actual human interchange.
Yes, but in exchange for your infinite responsibility, the other can give you forgiveness. Forgiveness for your infinite responsibility, for the things that you're not really responsible for.
These are all the senses in which you are indicating we're at the limits of language. I think this is why Krishna says we're at the very limits of what can be stated in proposition.
Yes,
that could then be regarded as true or false. Thank you very much for all your comments.